Make Me Smart is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Hello, everyone. I'm Molly Wood. Welcome back to Make Me Smart, the show where none of us is as smart as all of us, especially on Tuesdays. We have a super special smart day because Kai is out and the wonderful Mariel Segarra is here.
Yeah, thanks for having me. It is Tuesday, which means it's time to deep dive into a single topic. And today we're discussing data privacy.
Yes, as has been said on my show, I think I might have said on this show, there is an argument to be made that the pandemic pretty much killed what was left of our privacy. We moved all of these aspects of our lives online, work and school and doctor's visits and grocery shopping. And we were worried about contact tracing. Some may have come to pass, some may not have come to pass. But we're going to talk overall about the pandemic's privacy pitfalls, the three Ps, if you will, and the risks that remain as we come out of the pandemic.
Here to make us smart is Harvard Professor Emeritus Shoshana Zuboff, author of The Age of Surveillance Capitalism, The Fight for a Human Future at the New Frontier of Power. Shoshana, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me. Great to be with you.
So I guess let's start with our central premise. What do you think about this idea that the pandemic may have ended privacy in a lot of different ways?
Not necessarily. Look.
Okay, good. Good. Good start.
Really, it's both a lot worse and a lot better than what you just said, Molly. So
okay, good.
If we're really honest, long before March 2020, when at least, you know, in the U.S. is when the pandemic really hit us, we have lived through the wholesale destruction of privacy. To say anything less than that is really to ignore reality. This was already the case. Now, as the leading surveillance capitalists, saw the pandemic coming, and they looked at this and they, you know, began to like rub their silverware together because this was going to be a crisis that they could really colonize as a great opportunity. And they did. So there is no question that the pandemic has driven financial growth for these companies. But the key thing to know is that even though it has been the best of times for them in some ways, this is also becoming the worst of times for them because their ubiquity and their audacity, their invasiveness has poked the sleeping giant of democracy one too many times. And there is a substantial backlash. People like Eric Schmidt, former CEO of Google, former chair of Alphabet, like to say right at the beginning of this pandemic wave that, hey, this is the end of the tech lash now. Everybody's going to depend on us. Everybody's going to love us again. That has turned out to be the opposite of the case.
Well, maybe we can dig in on some of the specifics around privacy in this pandemic. One of the big questions I've heard around privacy right now has to do with vaccines and the data that retail pharmacies are getting access to. So do you have a sense of when you go to, say, CVS, Rite Aid, Walgreens, et cetera, to get a vaccine, what kind of data are they getting from you? And is it data they wouldn't have had before?
Okay, so this is a great place to start because if you look at the ways that the companies have really been able to double down on revenue and drive these huge increases in their market capitalization over this past year and a half, the very first one is just the expansion of business as usual.
And actually, Shoshana, Professor, can I jump in really quickly and clarify? When you're talking about these companies, are you, you're specifically talking about big tech companies and data that they might be gleaning?
I'm talking about big tech companies, but every application.
But so every company, right.
Okay. Every application. So now, you know, for a long time, what's happened around the big companies, the Google, the Apple, the Facebook, the Amazon, the Microsoft, have been ecosystems growing around them of smaller and mid-sized companies. So you get something like a Walgreens, a Walmart, a CVS. Many of these pharmacies and related companies that now are in the federal pipeline, they're receiving vaccines to give out for free to citizens. So they're looking for what's in it for them. And they are doing what they always do, which is if you want to have a Walgreens, discount card, if you want to order online from Walgreens, you've got to sign up. You've got to become a user. If you want to use Walmart remotely, if you want to use Walmart's pharmacy, you've got to sign up and you've got to give them a bunch of information. Well, now, if you go to one of these sites just to get in there for a vaccine, the very first thing you have to do is you've got to sign up to join Walgreens, to join Walmart, and they're going to grab all that data from you. Now, we don't know, and I believe that HIPAA, the health data regulations that are supposed to protect all of our health data, I have not been able to find any indication that they're actually grabbing, you know, vaccination data itself from us. But what we do know is that after you're vaccinated, you're supposed to wait for 15 minutes to make sure that there's no reaction. And that they have specific strategies, these stores, for taking advantage of the time that you're there for 15 minutes to show you lost leaders, to acquaint you with their merchandise, to try to get you to buy stuff is the bottom line. So this is what I call, you know, expanding business as usual. This is the kind of thing they're doing all the time anyway. COVID has given them an opportunity to expand their footprint to people who never would have been their customers.
Right.
Okay.
Well, and I would imagine that over time it would be somewhat trivial to connect, let's say, a person who just signed up for an account and used the one specific coupon that you received after you got a vaccine to buy something, that isn't a hard loop to close. Like if someone comes into Rite Aid, they sign up that day for a new account, they get a coupon that you only get once you have received a vaccine, and they buy the thing with that coupon and their brand new account, that none of this data is particularly anonymized, even if HIPAA is supposed to protect the health part of it.
That you have passed through, on these channels, it would strike me that they would certainly have a record of that. If the federal government had said, for example, to Walgreens, we're giving you vaccine, we're going to pay you for each person you vaccinate so that you don't collect data from them. That would have been a smart thing to do. That would have been a way to interrupt this cycle. But that has not happened. And instead, you know, this becomes a bit of a boondoggle for these companies.
So just to be clear, it sounds like the kinds of data that they're collecting, it's things like maybe names, emails, birthdays, stuff like that you would need to sign up for an account. But if it's your personal health data, all the things when you fill out a form, you get your vaccine, you have to say like, I have a history of allergies or whatever, stuff like that. That's not data that they can use to market to you, right?
That is what we believe. So, you know, these are things that are going to have to be, you know, investigated in detail and discovered in time. At this point, that is what we believe, that those data are protected by HIPAA and not available to their databases. But, you know, we'll see. this is still literally just happening. And as you can imagine, it's not easy to get transparency about it. But, you know, if they know that you've been vaccinated, and so that gives them something about you. Maybe it was 6 months ago, or maybe a little bit longer, when the discovery was made that Rite Aid had a secret facial recognition system set up in its stores. You know, this is why I say there are layers and layers. We don't always know, you know, right off the top, you know, what are the embedded systems that may be there, where, you know, facial recognition systems, they take your face, not only to ID you, but to get the micro expressions. Those are correlated with emotions. Emotions are great predictors of behavior. And those behavioral predictions indicate what kinds of things you're likely to buy. So very coveted data streams. Does Walmart have facial recognition? I haven't read that they do, but, you know, Rite Aid surprised us too.
One area of potential expansion, though, is this question about vaccine passports. Like, where do you come down on this idea that the Biden administration has decided to leave it up to states and the private sector to sort of potentially create databases of people who have been vaccinated and assign them permissions? What are the privacy concerns around that, in your view?
We need to get back to a place where we can put these questions in a public health context. And one of the things that the companies, and by this I'm talking specifically about Google and Apple, beginning with their exposure notification protocol, they put over this paradigm that you have to fear your government, and bizarrely, you're supposed to trust us, the companies that have just spent the last two decades utterly destroying privacy as we know it. So that was an incredible coup that they achieved right back at the beginning. And I think the vaccine passport conversation now is infected by that framework that they put out there, that kind of marketing paradigm that they bamboozled everybody with, that they're the champions of privacy. So vaccination passports. I remember as a little girl, when the polio vaccine became available, vivid memory. My dad took me to the doctor's office to get my polio vaccine. Normally they put it in the top of your, the side of your arm, like up near your shoulder. And I remember my dad saying to the doctor, you know, when my daughter has grown, she may be wearing an evening gown. And with an evening gown, I don't want her to have that mark on the side of her arm. So can you please put it on the back of her shoulder instead of on the side of her arm? Because the vaccination left a scar. That scar was your vaccination passport. And everybody had one. And we felt so relieved to be able to have that scar. It was a badge of honor.
Yeah, it sounds like you're saying that it's better for us in a way if the government knows whether we're vaccinated, but that we have been conditioned now to think it's better if the private sector knows or companies know.
It is complete folly for us to put our faith in the same companies that have destroyed privacy in the 21st century. And the fact that, you know, we're uneasy now that we've been so vulnerable to being made uneasy about trusting public health authorities, trusting our elected officials, is because we don't yet have everything we need to make sure that this digital world that we live in now is also a democratic world.
So one thing I've been thinking about a lot, to your point, is workplace privacy and how much things have changed during this pandemic. Many of us were forced to start working from home very suddenly, and we heard about companies installing tracking software on their employees' laptops. It made me wonder kind of what kinds of things are tracked, and would you know if your company had installed something like that?
The workplace is a really important topic here because, you know, the workplace is a setting where folks are captive. They can't leave unless they want to lose their job. So the workplace has really been kind of the experimental setting where surveillance has been developed. This goes back well into the 1980s, you know, when I first began my studies of surveillance inside workplaces, where they were first becoming computerized. You know, we have situations now where, for example, something as simple as a call center staff, you're at home now, you're monitored by webcam, they're checking on what you're eating, if you're looking at your phone, if you're leaving your desk, they're checking eye gaze and blinking. They're looking for any kind of abnormalities during work hours, what they call homework infractions. And these cameras are constantly clicking photos, and they send the photos to a manager whenever they think that an infraction has been detected. You can't eat while you're on shift. It detects, you know, keyboard strokes and mouse clicks and whether you're idle, what duration. So this stuff is draconian, but these same kinds of systems that I've just described to you have now migrated to school.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was my next question, is like, now we're seeing that with kids.
Oh, I mean, this is, of everything we've discussed, this is really what's keeping me up at night, because now we're seeing, you know, they call them school safety technology, which is a euphemism for these massive surveillance systems in schools and proctoring systems. You know, companies, they take and survey every digital trace of every student's, you know, daily life, every chat, every email, every file, let alone the coursework. These things are plugged into the whole Google education suite of tools, which has also vastly increased its footprint around the world during the pandemic. It's also linked into Microsoft, Microsoft 365, Microsoft Teams. Now, lest this be too depressing and you end up staying awake at night the way I do, I just want to round this out with a notification for everybody. And that is that this is beginning to engender tremendous resistance.
Right. That was my question, is do people know this now? And is that maybe the silver lining of the pandemic, is that we're starting to see this a little more clearly?
We are seeing this a lot more clearly. And this truly is the golden, not only the silver lining, but the golden lining in all of this nightmarish stuff. Look, why is all this stuff happening? There's only, you know, there are lots of reasons. But let me tell you the biggest reason, the simplest reason why all of this is happening. It's happening because democracy has failed to intervene to stop it. We do not have the laws to stop it, and we never have. Now, all over the world, including in the United States, everyday people, from students to householders, folks are rising up in a kind of wholesale rupture of faith with these companies and saying, what the heck? This is not okay. We are not going to take this anymore. When I say that, I hear in my head, I'm going to date myself. You know what I'm thinking of? Network.
Yeah.
Remember that great old movie with Faye Dunaway? I'm mad as hell, and I'm not going to take it anymore. But the idea, you know, for example, just late this summer, we had two huge surveys to come out late in the summer. After months of pandemic, one was Gallup and the Knight Foundation. The other was Accountable Tech. But in both cases, we saw the kind of majorities in the responses that we have never seen before. Yeah. I'm talking about in the 70th, 80th, and 90th percentiles, a complete loss of trust, concerned about misinformation, concerned mm-hmm. about privacy, far more than we're concerned about the so-called convenience of information, saying that the companies have too much power.
Professor Shoshana Zuboff, Harvard Professor Emeritus and author of the book, The Age of Surveillance Capitalism. Read the book if you want to know the rest of this story. But I am happy to hear that there's some hope on the horizon, Professor. Thank you so much for the time.
Yes, thank
you. Nice to talk to you.
We are going to head to a quick break. Send us your comments on today's show. You can do that by sending us an email or a voice memo to makemesmart@marketplace.org. We'll be right back.
With the launch of ChatGPT, Sam Altman and OpenAI reinvigorated our imaginations and fears of a world with artificial intelligence. While the company looked like a stunning success from the outside, a battle was brewing within on what the future of AI should be. Almost a year after launching ChatGPT, that battle erupted into a war when the company fired its charismatic CEO, Sam Altman. From Wondery, Business Wars is a podcast about the biggest corporate rivalries of all time. And in the newest season, host David Brown digs into the philosophical differences within OpenAI that culminated in Sam Altman's shocking firing, the chaos that followed, and what it means for the future and safety of AI in the modern world. Follow Business Wars on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen early and ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus. And for more deep dive and daily business content, listen on Wondery, the destination for business podcasts, with shows like How I Built This, Business Wars, The Best One Yet, Business Movers, and many more. Wondery means business.
All right.
All right.
We ended kind of abruptly there, but like, obviously, I'm still thinking about all of that.
Yeah.
Mariel, how do you feel? This isn't like as new to me, I'm afraid, as it might be to some of our listeners. So like, be our proxy. How are you feeling?
I think that reading about these tracking apps and tracking software that companies put on your laptop, I knew that such a thing existed before the pandemic, but it seems like it's been on an uptick. And it also just really made me wonder if you would know if that was on your laptop or not. And, you know, I think that it's one thing to say, like, this is company property. And so the things you're searching for, the things you're looking at, et cetera, should only be related to the company. But when you're at home, I think it can be a little hard. You could actually forget you're on your work laptop. You're sitting at the same desk. You have two laptops. Mm-hmm. You could forget for a minute, like, oh, I'm on my work laptop. So I'm going to search for my doctor or whatever. But you would think you're on your personal laptop and accidentally search on your work one. Or, you know, just the fear of having this computer, your work computer, in your space at all times. What if the camera's accidentally on and you walk by and you don't realize it? Work's over, but you know, you forgot to turn something off. Like, it's very intrusive.
Yeah, it really is. And I think that's been a big part of the remote experience in both work and school. You know, I mean, of course, Shoshana Zuboff's perspective is that this privacy was already dead. And I think that's probably true in some cases, but it did get exacerbated. There's no question, even just because your work came into your home and vice versa. Everybody can see, like, your room now, right? There's sort of all of these things in addition to the actual tracking that sounds really extreme when you hear her describe it. And you think, like, no, that can't be the case. And to varying degrees, it is. We were even slacking during the interview about, like, well, would you know? And is it actually happening? And I was like, well, it's happening on Slack, right? Every company that has Slack can read your Slacks. And it's kind of like, it's shocking when you round it all up like that. And it sounds unlikely. But the fact is, like, all the ingredients are there. And it's just a matter of how completely this technology is implemented and by whom.
Yeah.
But it's all real.
you know, I was talking about the idea of the computer now being in your home, work now being in your home. A woman I interviewed for, I did this story about makeup and how our opinions on it have changed during the pandemic. Some people are wearing a lot less and some have started wearing more. But this one woman said that she actually started putting on a full face again because she felt like nothing, she had nothing that was private anymore. Like she said, you know, now you're in my small, she lives in a tiny house, I think, you're in my small space. You get to see everything. The one thing you're not going to see is my bare face. Like I'm going to keep that for me and for my family and my spouse.
Wow.
You know?
Yep, totally. But yes, I mean, I think that's, everybody feels a little intruded on. I do want to say that on the topic of this pandemic-based privacy, my sort of mini news fix item was just related that I saw this morning, which was a story that came out in The Markup, which tracks, you know, big tech and what it's doing. It's a news outlet, but said that although Google, you know, these companies all rushed to put out these contact tracing apps at the beginning of the pandemic, and we sort of didn't hear that much about them. They were in use in other countries a little more than the United States, but when they introduced them 1 year ago, April 2020, they said, these will totally be private, right? All the data generated through these apps, which include like where you go and who you come in contact with and whether you've tested positive for COVID-19, would be anonymized. They would never be shared with anyone other than public health agencies. And evidently, at least in the case of the Android version, according to The Markup, it contains a privacy flaw that can allow that data to be accessed. And
of course,
researchers from a privacy analysis firm alerted Google to the problem in February. And Google failed to change it, they say. The company found no similar issues with the iPhone version of the framework. But
this is why nobody trusts anything.
Was leaky. This is why nobody trusts anything.
Like, really? Exactly. I mean, and you can hear the, like, government officials saying over and over again, yeah, download this app. It's 100% anonymous. I don't believe anything is 100% anonymous anymore. I actually downloaded one of those apps at one point and then just decided not to use, like deleted it almost instantly. Cause I was like, no, this is too much. Like, I don't trust this. I hate that. But then you find something this and it's like, okay, well.
And it could have actually been really useful, and it could have been a powerful public health tool, and yet nobody trusts it, which I think does speak to the part where we have to, like, reclaim this. We just have to. All right, I'm going to make the executive decision. What do you think, that we should move on to the mailbag? Let folks talk to us
for
a minute.
Yeah, absolutely.
Take a little break.
That sounds great.
All right, let's do the mailbag.
Hello, Molly and Kai.
It's Brianna from Phoenix.
Ivan from Brooklyn, New York.
Longtime listener, first-time voicemailer.
I want to discuss a slightly different but maybe related thing.
All right, in slightly different things, back to last week's show. Actually, our first voice memo comes from Alex in Dallas. It's in response to last week's episode on reparations.
Hi, Kai and Molly. I'm an African-American woman, and while I understand and see the well intentions behind the guest reparation proposal, the aspect I keep getting stuck on as a problem is their argument that the federal government is the only institution that should handle this. In my eyes, the policies and programs that already exist that have federal oversight should be improved and may be a better use of the efforts. We already have so many, so why give up on them? Addressing things like discrimination against Black people for housing or business loans. Continue the work of criminal justice reform or access to affordable and high-quality K-12 education. These and more, which are already policies that exist, would do a lot more to address various inequities than reparations would. I believe we should remain focused on those policies and try to create a whole new one to throw out the wall and see if it sticks. Under their qualifications, I probably would receive this hypothetical money. And honestly, I wouldn't want it. If all of the political capital was taken away from these other programs and efforts I mentioned, and more that I did not, in order to make this happen.
Yeah.
That's an interesting perspective. I would hope and imagine, I wish we could call them back up. I would hope and imagine that the reparations proposal is a both and.
Right.
Scenario, both reparations and existing programs. But I could definitely see, to Alex's point, a scenario in which governments, states, you know, organizations, agencies said, well, look, we have reparations now, so we don't have to do all of this other stuff. And that
right.
that would be a tough trade-off.
Yeah, I think that I could absolutely see that happening. So definitely an important perspective.
That's a good point. Yep.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. All right, well, next up we have a voice memo from Richard in New Hampshire.
Kai was wondering what serious cryptocurrency people think about Dogecoin. And, well, I don't know exactly how serious any of us are, but seeing that I've been running Ledger, the first peer-reviewed cryptocurrency journal, for the last 5 years, I guess that's probably me? In answer to your question, I'd like to refer back to something Molly said a couple of weeks ago. For us, Dogecoin is a very big boat stuck in a very small canal. We unironically love it. It's the best. Thanks for keeping me informed and for making me smile.
Dogecoin is like that poor Russian guy stuck on the Chinese boy band show. They're just going to keep voting him in because it makes him laugh.
It's kind of delightful.
It's kind of delightful. Also, Richard, I want you to call me back and tell me what you think about this climate situation. For real, though. All right. One more voice memo. Here comes Luke from Iowa.
I've been listening to Make Me Smart from the beginning, but last week I listened while painting soccer pitch lines at our club fields. Over the weekend, we had soccer games, and it was mostly normal. Coaches and referees had to wear masks to and from the field. The spectators were encouraged to wear masks and social distance, but it was really good to see the kids playing soccer again. Now, even though Earlham's only about 90 miles west of Ottumwa, I probably won't ever get to have a drink with you in person. So instead, I will have an Imperial Stout while I'm listening to Economics on Tap with the friends I have never met, Snarky Pants Woods and Eeyore Risdell. Keep dropping great episodes and making us smart.
Wow. You got called out. Snarky Pants Woods and Eeyore Risdell.
I mean, he's not wrong, is the thing. That's how you know we really are friends. Because like you can tell each other the truth. Mm-hmm. Oh my god. All right. What do we got next? Ooh, the Make Me Smart. My favorite.
Oh yeah. Okay. So now we're going to leave you with the answer to the Make Me Smart question, which is, what is something you thought you knew that you later found out you were wrong about? And today's answer comes from Mitch in California.
I thought that I knew that a bulldozer was a construction vehicle with a blade on the front to push things around. Thanks to another podcast that I love, The Illusionist by Helen Zaltzman, I now know that the term is from the end of the Reconstruction era. It was when bulldozing was the term that was used for white people suppressing the black vote, often violently, specifically in the election of 1876. There was, in fact, even a pistol named the bulldozer in 1877. The word wasn't actually used for a blade attached to mules to scrape things out of the way until the early 1900s, or to add to a tractor until the 1920s. So while bulldozer was definitely the wrong name to use for that construction vehicle, perhaps bulldozer bills would be an apt name to use for the majority of voting-related bills being pushed all around the U.S. right now.
Yeah.
Whoa! Did you know this?
I did not.
Me neither.
Really surprising, but it's one of those things that there are so many words like this and that have this history you had no idea about. And when I think about this as a reporter, we try to be really intentional about the words we use, what they mean, what their history is, and to know kind of exactly what we're saying when we say it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know, sometimes a word has changed, or it's been long enough since it was used that way that most people don't know it.
Yeah, I had no idea. I love this show. Thank you to everybody who called us, emailed us, sent us a voice memo. I'm still like reeling from that. That's just a remarkable thing to learn. Please don't forget to send us your answer to the Make Me Smart question. As you can see, it is a teaching opportunity. That question again is, what is something you thought you knew that you later found out you were wrong about? You can reach us one more time at makemesmart@marketplace.org. Thanks, Marielle, for coming on.
We gave you a whopper. Thanks for having me. This was fun.
Yep. Gave you some nightmares. No big deal. You're welcome.
Big topic. Thanks.
All right. See you tomorrow, everybody. Make Me Smart is produced and directed by Marissa Cabrera, who had her hands full this week. Tony Wagner is our digital producer. Erica Phillips writes our newsletter and our smart speaker skill.
Today's program was engineered by Liana Squillaci, with mixing by Emma Erdbrink. Ben Tolliday and Daniel Ramirez composed our theme music. The senior producer is Donna Tam, and the executive director of On Demand is Sitara Nieves.
And I'm Snarky Pants Wood. I'll be back tomorrow. Just mad about stuff. That was hilarious.
I kind of want a nickname now. I feel a little left out.
No, I mean... Oh, it's only a matter. Don't you worry. Don't you worry. You'll have one by tomorrow, probably.
Yes.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.